Gonzalo Fernandez de Oviedo y Valdez, who was an adventurer and explorer for Spain, was sent to the New World to find gold. As it turned out, he was also a foodie. I think they were already using that word in the early 16th century. And he observed how the people in the Spanish Caribbean territories ate. In 1526, he wrote Natural History of the West, the first record of New World food, and he was the first to report on barbecue activity. He was obviously onto something because these days, U.S. consumer spending on barbecue grills totals around $3 billion annually. That's about 14 million barbecue grills sold each year. So on this hot summer day, Please Explain is all about barbecue. And joining me are Steve Reichlin, whose book, The Barbecue Bible, changed the way millions of Americans have cooked since. It's celebrating its 10th anniversary and has just been revised and re-released by Workman. And my other guest is Chris Lilly, one of America's best-known barbecue pitmasters and vice president of Big Bob Gibson Barbecue in Decatur, Alabama. Welcome to the show, both of you gentlemen.
Hello, how are you?
I'm okay. Chris, you broke onto the scene in 1992 at Big Bob Gibson Barbecue Restaurant, which the Wall Street Journal says has the best pork barbecue in the country. Are you willing to reveal any of the secrets about what makes your pork so good?
Absolutely. What do you want to know?
So it's no secret, really? Anything that you do, you are willing to tell everybody?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's one of those things. You know, Big Bob Gibson started doing this in 1925 in Decatur, Alabama. So barbecue is one of those things. You can share the recipe. You can tell them exactly what you put on it. But it is actually the cooking technique. And I guess knowing how to do it and the time that is spent while the meat is on the grill, that's what makes barbecue. So it's more than just the recipe. It is. There's a lot of history and time involved in order to get, you know, really good at this.
And I'd need all of the equipment necessary because low and slow can mean different things for different people.
Absolutely. First and foremost, people have to realize there is a difference between grilling and barbecuing. You know, grilling is cooking over direct heat at hot temperatures for a short period of time. Barbecuing is cooking over indirect heat, low and slow, at low temperatures for a long period of time to render your meat tender and succulent. So it's two different style cooking methods, but there is a gray area between the two that I use a lot. As a matter of fact, sometimes when I barbecue, you know, I'll finish my ribs or my pork or my chicken over high heat as well. So there is a gray area there, and I'm not a stickler, although you do have some barbecue purists that might say you have to stay low and slow, but not me. You know, I go back and forth.
Does it require special training to become a world-class pitmaster? Is there a barbecue school with advanced courses in pork pulling?
You know, what I like to tell people, the greatness of a pit master is determined by the size of his ash pile, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah. we'll come back to that. Let's bring Stephen into this. Stephen, why has the Barbecue Bible, which came out 10 years ago, been credited with reinventing barbecue? Did you do something different?
Well, what I did, Len, is I actually traveled around the world and studied barbecuing and grilling at the time in 25 countries. And what I tried to do was bring international flavors and techniques used by Jamaicans to make jerk, used by Indonesians to make satay, used by Indians to make tandoori. Because barbecuing and grilling, when I say barbecue, I mean both the specific low and slow technique, but also more generally live fire cooking. That's the sort of line in the sand for me. And it's a universal technique, but it's practiced on a very local level. It's some of the last truly local food and cuisine left in the world.
Even in the United States, we're talking very regionally, aren't we?
Very regional, absolutely. And that's one of the things, you know, in this day of Starbucks on every other street corner, it's really great to know that you only find barbecued mutton in Owensboro, Kentucky, and you only find barbecued chicken with white barbecue sauce in Alabama. I mean, I find that a very comforting notion.
Well, if you were to have, without knowing it, Chris Lilly's barbecue, pulled pork from Chris Lilly, would you know right away it was from Alabama?
In a heartbeat. And the telltale, what would give it away is the sauce. It's the world's only white barbecue sauce. It's a mixture of mayonnaise and vinegar and black pepper. Very distinctive.
So let's talk about those sauces, and I ask both of you to join in. There are sauces, there are dry rubs, there are wet rubs. What are the differences, and why one rather than another?
Well, I think the way to think about it is, for me, if I may start, there's sort of three windows of opportunity to flavor meats that are cooked by live fire cooking. And the first window of opportunity is when the meat is raw, before it goes on the fire. And that really would embrace one of three or four preparations. A rub, which is a mixture of dry seasoning ingredients, a wet rub, which is a sort of a spice paste, a marinade, which is a bath, basically, of liquid ingredients, and finally a brine, which is a saline solution that's sort of a special kind of marinade.
Let me back up for a second, because I understand it, a marinade really only affects the top two levels, cell levels of the meat. It really doesn't go much further. And if you were to inject it into the meat, you just wind up with a lot of mush.
Well, I disagree with you on respectfully on both accounts, and I know that that's been written, and I think one of the magazines sort of did a scientific study. But in India, for example, meats are marinated in yogurt for as much as 24 hours, and in Iran, meats are marinated for as long as 3 days. And there is a tenderizing and flavoring effect that goes far deeper than two or three molecules on the surface of the meat. So I know it's been written that marinades don't tenderize food. I disagree with that. At any rate, to come back to kind of the second window of opportunity, it's actually when the food is on the fire. And in a barbecue context, that might be a mop sauce, which is traditionally applied with a clean mop. And the characteristic of mop sauce is that they tend to be less thick and less sweet than a barbecue sauce. Other sort of during cooking flavorings might include basting mixtures, butters, glazes. These are all sort of applied while the food is cooking, so there's a very different kind of chemistry and physics involved. The last window of opportunity is to apply a flavoring after the meat or the food comes off the grill. What might that be? For me, it's barbecue sauce, because I like to put barbecue sauce on either right at the very end or serve it on the side. It might be a salsa, it might be a fruit ketchup, it might be a chutney, a relish, something that sort of goes as a complement to and not an ingredient directly in the barbecue.
My guests are Steve Reichlin, author of The Barbecue Bible, just out in a new edition from Workman, and Chris Lilia, world champion pitmaster. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We're talking about barbecue on today's Please Explain. Chris, which one of those approaches would you use?
You know, it all depends on what you're cooking. And Stephen did an excellent job covering every aspect of what you might do to your meat before, during, and after your cooking process. It all goes back to what you're cooking. Let's say you're cooking a pork butt, okay, and you want to use a marinade. Again, in my opinion, there's no way you can pull the – because, you know, your pork butt may be 5 inches thick. So I think your marinade is only going to flavor and tenderize the outside portion or the outside bark. Whereas if you used a thinner cut, absolutely that marinade could go all the way through.
But it will give you a little crust when it is over direct fire.
Oh, definitely, even with or without the marinade.
Mm-hmm.
But in that case, when I'm cooking larger cuts, my options tend to go toward injecting or perhaps brining as well. Because brining works off the concept where you're putting a liquid with a saltier solution around a piece of meat that has a salt content, but not as quite as high as the liquid. And through osmosis, the meat absorbs the salty liquid throughout the meat. And you can pull flavors further into your meat using a brine than you can with a marinade. Also, injecting, I view injecting as a sort of a quick way to marinate. A lot of times during a thick cut, a pork butt or pork shoulder, even whole hog, I will inject the larger cuts of meat and pull the flavors all the way through to the bone and then instantly go on the cooker as opposed to letting it sit for, you know, 12 or 24 hours to absorb the liquid. And that is where I find the advantage of an injection.
Now, all of the cuts of meat you're describing are among the cheapest, and often brisket is cooked when beef is applied. Is barbecue better when the cut is really inexpensive and perhaps a little tougher?
Well, you've got to go back and view what barbecue really is. You know, barbecue throughout the history of especially the United States is the larger cuts of meat or the castaways, the pieces of meat that nobody else wanted. You know, at one time, beef brisket and ribs, baby back and spare ribs, those were just castaway cuts almost that they ground up and used where they could. That was cheap meat. So barbecue over the years is taking your larger cuts of meat or the cuts of meat that nobody wants, the real tough, overworked muscles, cooking them low and slow over indirect heat to yield succulent results. And it's that time and low temperature that makes it so good. So typically over the years, barbecue is using the worst cuts of meat or the larger cuts of meat. So that's what barbecue is. So I would say absolutely. Barbecue is taking your worst cuts of meat and making them fine through the cooking technique.
In a few minutes, we'll be taking listener calls. Our number here is 646-778-3729. That's 646-778-3729. Before we go to the call, Stephen, just for the people who grill in the backyard, do you think that one is better than the other, gas, wood, or charcoal?
Well, my preference would be for wood, because wood gives you not only heat, but it gives you flavor. And it's a lighter smoke flavor than the woods. It's the way wood is traditionally used in traditional American barbecue. However, that being said, you can produce great results with charcoal. And there is you often mix the two. You also often use a bed of charcoal for heat, and then you toss soaked wood chips or chunks on the coals for smoke. But I will probably sound like a bit of an iconoclast here, but there's some pretty fabulous grilling that is done over gas as well. And, you know, when I say gas, I mean I really do truly mean grilling. You cannot barbecue over gas. And you especially can't do it in a home grill. So even if you own and love your gas grill, you know, I recommend buying an inexpensive charcoal grill for smoking.
Let's take a little break here. We'll be back with more from Steve Reichland, author of the Barbecue Bible, 10 years old now and reissued in a new updated version. And we'll find out what we needed to update on something as ancient as barbecuing. It's published by Workman. And Chris Lilly is here. He is a world champion pitmaster. His restaurant is Big Bob Gibson Barbecue in Decatur, Alabama. We're back with today's Please Explain, and we will be taking your calls in just a moment. Our number here is 646-778-3729, and we have two of the world's leading experts on grilling and barbecue, Steve Reichland, whose book, The Barbecue Bible, changed the way millions of Americans have cooked since it was first released 10 years ago. It's just been reissued in a revised edition by Workman. Also here is Chris Lilly, one of America's best-known barbecue pitmasters, world champion. How many competitions do you enter regularly, Chris, in any given year?
Yeah, lately it's gotten fewer and fewer. I've done over the years, I've probably been competing for about 10 years, and I've the most I've ever done in a year is about 9 competitions. But this year, I'm lucky if I can get in three, but they will be the big ones, the Memphis in May, the World Championship there, and the American Royal International Championship in Kansas City. And I may sprinkle in another one here and there.
Now, go ahead. Steve, I was going to ask you what needed to be updated in the Barbecue Bible.
Well, many things. First of all, we added 100 color photographs, and many of them are of finished dishes, so you get an idea of what you're looking for. We also added a number of series of technique shots, for example, how to butterfly a pork loin, or how to make and stuff your own sausage, to sort of give people the hands-on how-to. The second thing we updated, and this was a really interesting part of the book to work on, the introductory material, which has gone from a very brief crash course on barbecuing and grilling to a 60-page exhaustive essay on all of the new grills that, when I first wrote the Barbecue Bible, were not available, infrared grills, for example, pellet smokers. We've included 150 frequently asked questions that cover everything from the difference between prime and choice meat to is it really worth the extra trouble to buy Kurabuta pork. Just a lot of, you know, there's a lot of new information. Finally, the third thing we needed to do, and this really took me by surprise, but when I wrote Barbecue Bible, the typical baby back rib you found in a supermarket weighed about a pound to a pound and a quarter. And these days, the weight is typically more like 2 to 2.5 pounds. So that's actually an ingredient whose dimensions have changed. Or an ingredient like fresh lemongrass. When I wrote the Barbecue Bible for the first time, it was not widely available. Today you can find fresh lemongrass in most supermarkets.
And you even have some grilling for vegetarians in this book.
Well, a big chapter on that. That sort of comes from a personal misfortune. When I was writing the original Barbecue Bible, both my wife and my daughter became vegetarian. Fortunately, they have come to see the error of their ways, and both are now on.
Oh, I'm going to get letters.
Okay, but it was a matter of self-defense. You know, actually, sort of my line about vegetarian cooking, you know, there are about 300 million vegetarians in India, and India has some of the most amazing barbecuing and grilling anywhere on the planet. So, I mean, they sort of wrote the book on vegetarian grilling.
Well, since vegetarians often feel left out, we invite them to call us at 646-778-3729. Let's take some calls. Gregory from the Bronx. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, good afternoon. Good afternoon, Steve. Big fan
of yours.
Hello,
how you doing?
I'm doing great. It's an honor to speak to you.
Thank you.
Calling on behalf of my mom. She has a barbecue restaurant in North Miami Beach, which I understand is where you're from, down in Miami anyway.
What is it?
Well, it's called Barbecue Trails, and we've had a problem for a while with a brisket. Now, when we make a brisket, it comes out great, but the problem is with holding it because it's not very fatty, so it tends to dry out. What do you recommend to do to hold brisket so that it stays moist?
Well, you know, first of all, I don't cook lean brisket. I like a really fatty brisket.
Okay.
I buy a whole sort of packer brisket, and I work on the assumption that most of the fat will cook out, and what doesn't keeps the meat moist.
Right.
What I typically do is I wrap it after slicing it and then unwrap it each time, something that you see in the Texas Hill Country. But I think Chris is probably in a very, probably in a better position to tell you because Chris operates a commercial barbecue restaurant.
Okay, well, what would he recommend, Chris?
I will gladly jump in, definitely. What I typically do when I cook a brisket is I'll pull it up to about 170 degrees internal temperature, get a nice brown dark bark on it. But then I'll wrap it, and I'll actually put a little water in there to actually sort of build an au jus with the rest of the cooking. So I'll then bring the internal up within the foil wrap to about 185 degrees and then pull it off. And we want to make sure you give the brisket time to rest. So pull it off the cooker, leave it in the foil, set it on the counter, let the brisket stop cooking, and then start coming down a little bit before you ever think about unwrapping it, okay? It'll give the juices inside the meat a chance to redistribute, and if you slice too soon, sometimes the meat will dry out. Next advice is I will tell you to leave it whole as long as possible, okay? Do not pre-slice your brisket and try to hold the slices for any length of time.
Right.
You want to pretty much slice to order or keep it whole as long as possible before you start slicing your brisket. Also, you can use the au jus that's trapped in the bottom of aluminum foil to rehydrate your brisket after you cut the slices.
Now, we've done that, and it works. The only thing is that when we wrap the brisket the first time, it does stay moist, but it loses a bit of that barbecue in the crust.
Any time you wrap with aluminum foil, whether it be brisket, ribs, you know, you spend so much time building that bark and building that great flavor and dark crust on the brisket or ribs. Whenever you wrap anything in foil, you're going to cook with steam as well, and it will wash some of that flavor and some of that dark crust off, you know, while you're doing it. When I wrap, I put flat side up, so meat up, the fat cap down or the point down, and I keep the flat out of the au jus or out of the grease, okay, to protect some of that color when I wrap it.
Okay. Well, by the way, as I understand it, in the South, there isn't a lot of beef that's cooked in barbecue. That's kind of Texas and other places.
Texas and the West Coast.
How much brisket do you actually cook there, Chris?
I tell you, more and more. It is an item that we added probably 5 years ago after we started winning a bunch of competitions with our brisket. But that, I'll tell you, the learning curve on doing a brisket, you know, probably took about 3 or 4 years. But once we mastered it, we really started being successful with our brisket. We introduced it to the restaurant, and now it's gaining popularity here in the South.
Now, Steve, why do you think it is that that pork dominates in the South, and once you have to go to Texas before you start seeing a lot of beef?
Well, I think it really goes back to the kind of meat that was raised in a particular region. If you look at early histories of the Carolinas in the South, the settlers are described as pork eaters. That was the animal that was raised. In Texas, on the other hand, it was ranching country. There was the great cattle run that took cattle from Fort Worth up to Kansas City. That's, by the way, why Kansas City is also a big beef region, because it was a major meatpacking process. But in general, you know, barbecue, it's very much like wine grapes. It's very much like cheese. It's the French have a word, it's called the terroir of the earth. It's really it's really made with the traditional meats ingredients that are raised in a particular area.
Why do we see less lamb? Does it not barbecue
America's
as well?
Americans are not big lamb eaters. About the only barbecued lamb in the American tradition is the barbecued mutton of Owensboro, Kentucky. It dates back to a group of settlers in the early 1900s who were primarily sheep farmers. However, if you look at the world picture, on any given night, probably more people are grilling and eating lamb than any other meat in the world. Lamb country starts in Mauritania. It goes across North Africa, Southern Europe, through the Near East, the Middle East, down through Central Asia, India, and into Indonesia. I mean, it's just a gigantic part of the world is eating lamb for barbecue.
Our phone number here is 646-778-3729. I'm speaking with Steve Reichlin and Chris Lilly about barbecue on today's Please Explain. And Lisa, who is driving somewhere, is calling in. Hi, Lisa.
Oh, hi. How are you?
I'm okay. Where are you driving? To a barbecue restaurant?
Well, that's why I called. I need some help. We're actually in the Hudson Valley right now, and we're driving towards Herkimer County, way upstate New York, northwest of Albany. And I know Steve used to be based in Boston, and I thought he might know some off-the-beaten-track places. We might find some good barbecue.
Well, in that particular area of New York, I don't. Let me ask you, how close are you to Cornell, New York?
Cornell, New York. You mean Ithaca?
Yeah, Ithaca in that area. Syracuse and Ithaca.
No, not as far
nowhere
west
near there.
As, no.
Yeah.
More like Utica, Rome, New York, Gloversville,
I'm
the Mohawk
afraid
Valley.
Yeah, I'm afraid I can't help you, but let me make two points. And number one is that barbecue isn't meant to be eaten everywhere. You know, one of the great pleasures of barbecue is sometimes that you have to wait to get to a particular region to enjoy it. But if you do ever happen to be up in that Ithaca area, one of the least known and most interesting regional styles of barbecue is called Cornell chicken. And it's a chicken that's grilled with perhaps the only barbecue sauce I know that is based on eggs and oil and poultry seasoning. It was developed by a poultry scientist at Cornell University, and you find it done at country fairs, usually in the summer in that area and nowhere else on the planet. And, you know, for me, that's the bingo moment when there's a style of grilling that that is found in one place and one place only.
We have some listener comments. One listener wonders about using sauce on the meat over the fire because burnt sugar is supposed to be a carcinogen. Is that true?
Well, first of all, let me say that I apply I usually serve sauce on the side, but when I apply it, it goes on right at the end directly over the fire to sort of form a glaze. Also, very important point, you know, there's a difference between grilling or smoking and burning, okay? And we're looking for grilled but not burnt. You know, no burnt food is good food. I also want to say that, you know, the idea of cooking meat over live fire, it happened about 500,000 years ago. It was a powerful evolutionary force. If you look at skulls of our ancestors before we cooked meat over fire, after we started cooking meat over fire, you can see the emergence of the modern face and the modern brain thanks to eating grilling. So if it were really dangerous to cook meat over fire, you know, we wouldn't be here.
Let's take another call. Mark from Westfield, New Jersey. Hold on one second. Okay, hi, Mark. Mark, are you there?
Yes, I am. Do you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. I have a simple question. I don't eat meat. My family eats a lot of fish, a lot of salmon, and occasionally some tuna steaks. Could you give me a simple recipe that I can grill on my grill? I don't have... Yeah, I don't think I can get really into the barbecuing aspect, but is there something simple I could do?
Absolutely. Have you ever heard of planked salmon, Mark?
No.
Well, what planked salmon is, it was actually originated in and inspired by the Pacific Northwest. You can buy cedar grilling planks. They're planks that are typically 6 inches wide, about 12 inches long, quarter of an inch thick. You soak them in water for about an hour and then put the salmon on top. Simple glaze might be two parts mayonnaise, one part mustard, and a little chopped dill. Or another version is to put a salmon fillet on the plank and brush it with mustard and then sprinkle it with brown sugar. The cooking process is indirect grilling. That is, you're cooking next to, not directly over the fire. What kind of grill do you have, Mark?
It's a gas grill.
How many burners?
Two.
Okay, so what you'd do is you'd set one light one side on high, and you'd actually cook with your plank on the other side. That's known as indirect grilling. You turn the plank halfway through, cooking time about a half an hour for a pound and a half salmon fillet. And I promise you, the combination of the flavor of the cedar aromas, the simple glaze on top, it's fantastic. Plus, the beauty of the preparation is the fish will never stick to your grill grate because
it's
on a plank. You don't have to worry about turning it. Plus it looks really fantastic. Never underestimate the importance of presentation.
Okay, thank you so much. I do appreciate that.
Now,
great.
Thank you. Now, if he wasn't going to use a plank, should he just put a lot of olive oil on the grill or on the fish?
Well, I recommend doing three things. First of all, start with a screaming hot grill, brush it with a stiff wire brush, oil it with a folded paper towel dipped in oil and drawn across the bars of the grate. I also recommend, probably in that instance, if he uses a salmon steak, it's less likely to stick and fall apart than a salmon fillet. Finally, I recommend brushing the fish on both sides lightly with oil before applying it to the grill.
Let's go to Donna from Union, New Jersey. Hi, Donna. You're on the air.
How you doing? I am a vegetarian, and so I thought I'd take you up on your offer to find out about other types of foods to grill besides meat. We we eat a little bit of fish, and so that was great to hear about the salmon steak. But there are a lot of other types of foods that we eat. We eat bean curd and tofu and a frozen product actually called corn, Q-U-O-R-N. That's excellent. It's a mycoprotein. But I'm wondering if there's any techniques that would be different from the ones that you're talking about for vegetarian proteins.
And we have very little time.
Real quick, specialty of Japan, it's sort of as popular in Japan as hot dogs are in the United States, tofu grilled with a miso barbecue sauce.
Wow.
You find it on street corners everywhere.
That sounds
actually,
great.
You'll find a recipe for that in the new barbecue Bible.
And Chris, would you have any suggestions?
You know what my suggestion would be is to first go out and buy the new version of the barbecue Bible, and then go out and buy a book by Stephen called How to Grill. If you call yourself a barbecue aficionado or think of yourself, those are two musts that you have to have in your library.
By the way, listeners have called in to recommend a couple of restaurants to that caller, Piggy Pat in Utica, and another one says PJ's in Saratoga Springs. I have no idea whether they're any good or not, but they are barbecue restaurants, and you might try them. And you definitely might want to, if you're ever in Decatur, Alabama, stop by and say hello to Chris Lilly at Big Bob Gibson's. That's
it is a must-visit restaurant.
Thank you both so much for being with us.